Welcome to the Future Work Playbook. This podcast series features founders, investors, and legal talent that will help you embrace technology and transform your organization for a better future. This series is hosted by Natalie Pierce, the chair of Gunderson Dettmer's Labor and Employment Law Practice. Natalie and her guests are committed to helping you develop new playbooks to elevate your game.
Hey, this is Natalie. I'm excited because today we're featuring robots. And these aren't just any robots. You'll see what I mean. To talk about these robots' impact on the future of work, we're joined by Dr. Samir Menon. He's the founder and CEO of Dexterity, a company engineering intelligent robots with human-like dexterous manipulation skills. Dexterity came out of stealth a year ago with a fresh $56 million financing round from venture leaders such as Kleiner Perkins, Lightspeed, and Obvious. As we move into the end of this future work playbook season, addressing the theme of return to the workplace, Dr. Menon brings us a true example of how robots and the future of work played an important part during the pandemic and how we can continue to power human capability. Samir, welcome. It's so wonderful to have you as our guest. As I mentioned before we started this podcast, I have been very much looking forward to this.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've really been looking forward to this particular episode. So I'd love to jump in and have you preface our discussion with the story of Bimbos, the bread maker, which really showcases the work your team has developed.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to share a little bit about our robots. And I'd love to dive in, talk about Dexterity. We've been working on building the next generation of intelligent software that can drive just about any robot to do a wide variety of tasks that have been traditionally considered very difficult for robots to do. We're focused on logistics and warehousing, and our robots do things like picking, packing, moving, distributing, sorting. I think the story of one of our customers, Grupo Bimbo, starts with our idea of going to market with products that were extremely customer focused, that zoned in on some very, very interesting technical problems. To solve the technical problems, keep us very excited, but at the end of the day, that are able to drive value with our customers. And so when we look at robotics, robots have been around for quite a few decades. They've traditionally been very, very effective in situations that require precision and reliability. And so a precise robot could do things like weld a car, it could assemble a phone. Unfortunately, most of the world is not completely precise and orchestrated. And when we take a step away from the world of precision and we enter the real world, it's a whole lot more challenging. And robots need a degree of intelligence because they don't exactly know what's going on. They need to see, they need to touch, they need to feel. And when we started Dexterity, it was our mission to give robots the intelligence to be able to do this. And what better place to start than with bread? So why bread? Well, I think for us, we wanted to go out and tackle the hard problems and to really focus ourselves where we could add value. And we can add value in a situation where there is a bit of a labor crunch. So robots can step in and assist people with doing their job. This was true of the packaged food industry. We could add value in cases where the tasks were hard to automate. This is again true in the packaged food industry. Why? Because every bread poofs differently. One day you're picking bread, the other day you're picking bagels, the other day you're picking pizza. Having robots that had the ability to be able to operate in an environment that was changing on an hour-by-hour basis and on a day-by-day basis in an essential business that was literally putting bread on people's plates every day. So this was a very exciting opportunity for us. And that's where we started. We were also quite surprised and caught on the back foot when the corona pandemic started. This was right around a little while after we started our company. But it turned out to be for the better, because one thing, you know, that appeared at the very start of the pandemic were these massive supply chain shortages. And they highlighted how sensitive our civilization is to even minor disruptions in logistics, and gave us an excellent opportunity for us to put our robots in production. Our robots packed bread during the pandemic. You know, we were very grateful to have the opportunity to ship millions of units of bread to fill those empty store shelves, which we all saw.
Wow. What a tremendous gift. Something, like you said, putting bread on people's tables during the pandemic when we're in a situation where you can't have humans tightly packed doing that kind of work, and just thinking about those supply chain challenges. I really do think it's such a perfect example. And we've talked about making robots more intelligent, but can you explain to our audience how a seemingly simple task such as picking up different objects, you know, different types of bread, can be really complex for a robot?
Absolutely. And so I think I'll build upon my earlier comment that robots are very, very effective at being precise.
Yeah.
So when we think about a way a human being operates in the real world, and you know, I was fortunate to have the opportunity to study human beings during my PhD at Stanford. I spent almost a decade trying to understand how humans move, what makes their brain so adept at dealing with picking and placing a very wide variety of items. And there are a few fundamental differences between the way in which we program robots and other machines and in the way in which human beings move. And so the first one I would say is that when humans encounter, say, a novel object, say a new type of cup that you might be handed, or some new cutlery, or there's a box that arrives in the mail that's of a different shape or heavier, human beings rarely spend too much time thinking about the exact manner in which they're going to pick up the object. And I think it's my sort of hypothesis that people operate in a what I call a categorical sense. Mm-hmm. So they brought categories of objects. It's like, hey, there's a cup. It probably has a handle, and I'm just going to go pick it up. Hey, there's a box. I'll probably need to use both my hands, and I might need to grab it and apply enough pressure so it doesn't fall off. Hey, there's a tennis racket. You know, there's probably some spot where I can grab it. And we build these categorical models of how to operate across a broad variety of shapes and sizes. On the other hand, when we look at robots, they typically, you know, because they rely on precision, we have to precisely define the task for them. Human beings never precisely define a task. And there's a substantial difference to the point where an object that is even subtly different from another object, say it's a cup that is a slightly curved handle, or it's a box that's slightly heavier, the precision breaks and you have to reprogram the robots to try and understand how to pick up this new object. Mm-hmm. And so if we look at the category of cups, there's probably hundreds of millions of cups all over the place, different shapes, sizes.
Right.
Human beings will only learn one canonical grasping motion. A robot will need to be taught 100 million motions. And so at dexterity, what we have been trying to do is to impart this a human level categorical style of dealing with the environment, where we learn broad patterns of different types of objects instead of learning each and every nuance of a particular object.
Wow. Those are really great examples, I think, for our audience. You know, what we have definitely seen is that the pandemic has enabled many companies to accelerate their growth and, as we've heard from your story, really power human capabilities. And the way that you describe teaching a robot to learn to deal with, you know, tens, if not hundreds of thousands of different types of objects, it really lends itself to, you know, this thesis that I've heard you discuss before about a robot ubiquity. Can you expand upon that thesis a bit for our audience?
Absolutely. And I think when we look at the future of robotics, the pandemic did bring, like I mentioned earlier, a glaring point to the fore, which was that the world really critically depends on our supply chains, on our logistics. Now, this is something that we often forget. If I go and buy something from the store, I think I spent more than 35 years of my life never really thinking about where it came from. I just pop into the store, put down some money, and take something home.
Yeah.
There's a very, very complicated process that goes from producing a product to getting it to a point where it can end up in the hands of a customer. And it's a very manual, sort of labor-intensive process with many things to be done that tend to be highly repetitive in nature. At Dexterity, when we started the company, I have a firm belief that repetitive work tends to be less appreciated by human beings, let's put it that way, compared to work, that maybe actually brings out their intelligence that allows them to express themselves in novel ways. And so it's been a personal mission of mine to make a repetition optional for pretty much all humanity. And so robots are an expression or a tool that allows us to sort of pursue this goal. With the pandemic, what happened was supply chains came under pressure. Supply chains also and warehouses were frequent locations where there were outbreaks of the coronavirus. The working conditions tend to be very difficult. And as a consequence, the supply chains were pretty badly hit by a labor shortage to a degree that they haven't yet recovered. Companies realized that they need to invest in improving worker conditions, in adding automation and robots to do tasks that otherwise might have been hazardous or require very, very hard labor. Mm-hmm. So this has accelerated sort of interest in automation, but automation not just from the perspective of, hey, let's throw in some sort of spot machine that does a task, but automation from the perspective of how can we think about transforming the future of the supply chain. It benefits our employees, it benefits the customer, and it benefits society as a whole. And so I think what the pandemic really did is it unlocked this idea of transformation, and it's time to rethink the entire way that we do our supply chain. So that was really critical. I think Dexterity fits right in. We are all about transformation, and I would love to see a transformation where repetition becomes optional for us all.
Yeah. No, the robotics being able to help with the dull, right, and dirty and dangerous, you've definitely been tackling that repetitive work. And I have to tell you, I saw a video from earlier this year. And, as we know, warehouses, they can be complex and the items changing all the time. And I saw the palletizing and depalletizing, at 900 picks an hour, which I just found extraordinary. And these were unstable pallets in many instances. And and when you think about the human, the repetitive movements and the human labor that has traditionally gone into that, but to be able to deal with different size packages and to depalletize with such precision, I just found it remarkable, Samir. I really did. With robotics and Dexterity, certainly a leading example, we're seeing such a tremendous amount of innovation. Can you tell us a bit more about where you're focusing the company and what it is that makes Dexterity unique or sets you apart from your competitors?
Absolutely. I would say, we spend a lot of time trying to figure out a position for Dexterity in the market. There's a few sort of basic, I would say, principles that guide the way we focus our company. I think the first one is we have deep respect for the folks who have been doing a lot of these repetitive labor jobs. I think it's just a huge service to a society that folks have been doing stuff like this, and we want to transform that. So I think the first positioning for us vis-a-vis what we see in the market is that a lot of the traditional market efforts have been focused on automation without a second thought for what is the best way for us to synchronize and optimize a human-robot team. Mm-hmm. And so I think if we put aside this classical notion of throwing in automation as required and substitute it with the notion of it's time to transform supply chains and warehouse operations so that they empower people by using robots as tools that, essentially make life better for everyone. And so I think the first axis would be this automation versus transformation axis, and we're pretty squarely in the transformation camp. There are few companies that actually have the technical ability to help customers with transformation, and we're glad to see that we are increasingly a leader in this space. The second axis that I would draw is when we look at the logistics and supply chain, There's a few things. The core purpose of this logistics and supply chain initiative is to take items from a production source and distribute them to the end consumer. Along the way, there's also a lot of storage, and we are primarily at the end where we are focused on distribution, not so much storage and retrieval. And so in warehouses, some warehouses just have items sitting there for months, and other warehouses are buzzing with activity. There's a lot of distribution ongoing. And so when we look at the market, I think there's a lot of companies focused on automation. There's few focused on transformation, and we're in the transformation camp. And then there's a lot of companies focused on storage and retrieval and logistics. And there's few that are truly focused on distribution, and we're in the distribution camp. So I think when we look at a company that is providing intelligent robotics to enable the next level distribution efforts and completely transform logistics and supply chain, I would say that's the focus of our company. And we do it on the back of amazing software. We do it with fantastic customers who are true believers in the future. Mm-hmm. And I believe it's going to lead to a great outcome for us all.
How exciting. So really, the next step is teaching robots how to collaborate with one another, where to go, scheduling dispatch. So the distribution and the connection with other systems to really hit that next level of supply chain challenge is, I find it fascinating. Samir, you've recently come up on your 1-year anniversary emerging from stealth. Can you tell our audience what that meant to stay secret for 2 years and why you did it?
When we think about stealth and, for the broader audience, a lot of startups, when they start up, they keep a low profile for a while till they figure out what they're all about. With Dexterity, we had a perspective that the purpose of the company is to make sure that we deliver value to society, to our customers, to end users. And it's not very easy to actually drive value in the market. I think one of the things that I learned, I did my PhD, spent 10 years in the academic world, and somewhat removed from the day-to-day reality of driving economic value in the real world. And so what we learned was it's actually pretty hard to solve real world problems. And when we started the company, we were laser focused on our customers to understand what we could do to solve problems for them. We're not about the hype. There were a lot of robotics companies that start up 2 days after they start up. They have a great PowerPoint presentation and they want to talk about, the next robot brain. We'll do that. But for us, that's the footnote that allowed us to have the ability to drive change. And so it did take us quite a while to talk to our customers, to understand where we could begin to have an impact. Logistics is a massive industry, massive. I mean, yeah. It's so huge, it's mind-boggling. It's almost impossible for the human brain to comprehend. Yeah. We needed to find our little toehold as a young startup. And it did take us about a year and a half to find a customer, make sure that our products were productive at solving problems that they cared about, to go out, have an impact in the real world. And then we were ready to talk about it. I think it just took about 2 years, but since then we've been making very rapid progress. I think I'm very happy to say that our robots have shipped millions of units, and we've encountered, I think, almost 50,000 types of items in the field.
Wow. Dexterity did, certainly enter a new phase of its journey with its Series A round last year. Along the journey, can you provide any guerrilla business secrets or stories that have really stuck with you?
I think the biggest secret is, at the end of the day, from my perspective, of course, and this is my two cents to a very wide variety of opinions, is I believe it's all about the people. At the end of the day, we are people, our customers are people, their customers are people, human civilization, the fundamental unit is people. And so when we think about business, it's very critical for us to understand. It's important for us to see the evolution of technology as a tool that's serving the people. When we work with our customers, it's critically important for us to understand that they have challenges that they are working with. We want to be humble, make sure that we serve them. our own team. It's very important that we have a very high bar, of course, and I would say startups are fairly stressful and quite intense, but we do want to give our team the opportunity to have an impact in the world, to sort of leave a mark. And then, of course, there's our responsibility to people in the broader civilization. And I do believe very firmly that if we look back a decade or so from now, you know, it's very important for us to be seen as a force for change, and a force for change that actually had a positive impact on society. So my guerrilla secret, I think it's all about the people, different timescales, different backgrounds, different walks of life, but it's all about the people.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And I do want to, you know, we talked about looking back a decade. And so let's talk about that future next 5 years or so. And what changes do you think are on the horizon, I guess, in terms of humanity and robotics, or just focusing on dexterity and what's on the horizon?
This is a very tricky question to answer. I'm going to sort of break it down into a slightly smaller question. And so when, you know, instead of what changes do we are likely to happen, I'll replace that with what changes I would like to see.
That's better. Yes.
Your question.
that's better. Yes.
So I think what I would love to see is within the space of technology, I think it takes time for technology to get adopted. When we looked at computers, you know, there was a slow ramp in the early days. I think we had computers, big mainframes in the 1980s. By the early 90s, there were somewhat smaller computers, sometimes even personal computers, and yet mass adoption, you know, was far away. And I strongly believe that robotics today is in the phase where computers were in the early 90s. You know, robots are still expensive. They tend to be isolated machines that are working by themselves, kind of like computers before the internet. They have a lot of potential, and the ramp to sort of accelerate their adoption, I believe, is started to appear. And so what I would like to see in over the next 5 years is our robots continuously demonstrating that exponential growth that we did see in the computer industry, that we did see in the cell phone industry, that we did see in the software industry, that we did see with the internet. And I think it's going to be delivered on the back of no-nonsense value that is created in the market, which I think is starting to become even more evident, which is going to be driven by a few but consequential early adopters. For now, I think for robotics, it does seem like the early adopters are companies that have sort of supply chains that are struggling from a labor shortage, and robots can come in and help them transform their operations to meet the future. But over the next 5 years or so, I would say we should see robots, at least in the tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, making their way to a point where I think if we look at industries like packaged food, like parcel, I think it would be very likely that hundreds of millions of people will have their lives touched in some way by a robot, be it that the robot helped them sort a parcel or picked out their bread, remains to be seen. I would see, you know, tens to hundreds of thousands of robots touching the lives of many millions, if not hundreds of millions of people.
You have me thinking about the production, you know, to produce at that scale, I think we're going to need robots to help build that number of robots. Would you agree, Samir?
I totally agree. Robots already build robots. The same way we need computers to build computers. And I think you're absolutely right.
So many startups do count on ambassadors and champions to help them along the way. And Samir, are there any ambassadors or champions or any big wins that you'd like to highlight on this podcast?
I'd love to share a short story at Dexterity. And I'm not a big believer in wins. I prefer to take slightly more humble stance. There's a very massive market out there. I think it's baby steps for everyone, and early wins are very encouraging. I think there are a few ambassadors. I think the greatest ambassador is, of course, our team. And I'd love to highlight a little bit about the interesting sort of journey of taking robots into production. So when we look at startups, they're all sorts of startups. And I think it's an unfortunate reality that many startups fail. what sets startups apart is something, what sets successful startups apart is something I've been struggling with over the past many years. And I think it requires a deep commitment from people to pursue a cause. The greatest possible ambassadors for us are folks who have a vision of the future where repetition is truly optional, where we, you know, empower our industrial and market enterprise to add efficiency, delegate all sorts of tricky jobs away from people and into the hands of machines where they should be. A few interesting wins for us have been to really help us align on technology that has a path to get there, I think, and go ahead and validate that technology in products that work. So when we think about our technology, folks who actually are going to make it happen, there's a message that we need to send to the market. The message that needs to be sent to the market is, hey, robotics is making progress. It's going to happen. Who are the people to send this message? The people to send this message are first and foremost our team who builds the technology. But then it's not just about building the technology. We're a small company. We can only do a small part of the entire puzzle. There's our partners. One of our other ambassadors is Kawasaki Heavy Industries. Love to call them out. They're one of the top five robot manufacturers in the world. They've been working on robots that were intended for automotive industries and for semiconductor. They've taken a very comprehensive sort of decision to focus on logistics, to focus on robots that eventually will be stepping outside the factories and into the real world. They've been working very closely with us to take our robots into production with our customers. There's our venture sort of capital backers. This includes Wen Shea, our partner at Kleiner Perkins, Ravi Rajan, a partner at Lightspeed, Nan Li, a partner at Obvious Ventures. They've been great ambassadors. I think it really helps us to rely on their expertise, to rely on the longstanding reputation of Kleiner Perkins, Lightspeed, to be able to go out and communicate that, hey, Team Dexterity has done the work. The technology is ready to be adopted. We have the right partners who can fill in the gaps, aka partners like Kawasaki, who can provide the hardware with the reliability that is required. And we have our evangelists in our venture capital partners who go out, talk to customers, talk to other folks to help join us, to join the cause and make robots a reality.
What phenomenal ambassadors and partners you have. Thank you for sharing that. And now we're going to turn to this part of the podcast where we always like to share practical suggestions with other founders and leaders in the technology sector. Are there any lessons or tips you picked up along the way that you wish you had known earlier, Samir?
Absolutely. For founders and other technology leaders, I would say technology is hard. I'm sure you've put your life into it. You know, my deepest respect to you. Please keep doing what you're doing. One particular lesson I would share, and this might be relevant for early stage founders, is when we started a startup, there's a canonical startup life cycle in our industry today, which is we come up with an idea, we go to map that idea into a product, we build a prototype of the product, take it to investors who see the promise of that product, they invest in the company, then we build the product, we take it to market, we build a sales team, try to sell it, make money, hopefully raise more funding and keep improving the product and so on and so forth. And I've taken, there's two things I would like to share here. One is, I think there's a lot of risk in taking, you know, this strategy of just having an abstract idea that you think is going to work and going all in on it. I would really love to share like a practical tip is when in doubt, go talk to a customer and ask them if it's going to work. This really helps. And, you know, it's quite humbling for folks like us, you know, people with, you know, all sorts of academic degrees. And the best lessons that we have learned have been lessons where we walked into a warehouse, you know, spoke to somebody who was packing a pallet, who had been doing that backbreaking work and just asked them, hey, do you think this is going to help you, this product? And they'll be like, yeah, maybe. And I was like, okay, well, what could we do to make it useful for you? And they are the most valuable source of information that I can possibly, you know, imagine for us. And my message and my tip over there to other startup founders is go talk to your customers all across the spectrum, not just the C-suite, the middle management, all the way down to folks who are on the ground. And please listen to them because you learn a lot. And technology, when it maps to real world problems, has a fantastic chance of success. It's still hard, but you know that if you succeed, you'll be doing something consequential. And no problem is too small. No problem is too big. You should take a stab at doing what you can.
That's such a good lesson learned. A good lesson, I guess, to share with others is that you're thinking of what you're trying to do. You're trying to enhance human capabilities. You're trying to take away some of this difficult work. And so to actually speak with the workers, not just the customer who has the purchasing power, right? But to actually speak to those who are on the line, it should be obvious, but I think that it's not. So to have your engineers go out there and have those conversations makes a lot of sense. And it's no wonder that your company has been so successful thus far. All right. So we're coming to the end of our podcast now, and we usually end by sharing with the audience a fun fact, a story, joke, favorite movie, you name it. And I'll start by sharing that I love watching dystopian movies about the end of the world as we know it. There's just something about post-apocalyptic world stories that I find fascinating. Anything that you're willing to share with our audience?
I would love to, actually. This is an interesting little journey that I had while we were exploring warehouses. And I love eating ice cream. I'm sure a lot of folks out there love eating ice cream too. And I'll share a small, insight into the journey of ice cream. And so I've been eating ice cream for many decades now. I just go to the store, I go buy ice cream, tastes great, all sorts of flavors. I'm so happy after I eat it. And I never really thought about how ice cream gets to the store. And I think once, we thought about taking our robots into an ice cream distribution facility. And so we were quite excited because I was like, sweet, well, ice cream's close to my heart. We'd love to have robots picking ice cream. And so we went in, we had an opportunity to engage with a potential customer. And they'll say, hey, are you sure you want to start with ice cream? And we're like, yeah, that sounds great. And so, well, you should go into an ice cream warehouse and first check it out. And I was like, sweet. Yeah, we'd love it.
Even better. This is getting even better. Yeah.
Right. So sure enough, we drive down to this ice cream warehouse, and I didn't quite realize that ice cream, a lot of it has eggs in it, and you basically have to keep it very cold, and very cold as in minus 30F. And so minus 30F is extremely cold. And so the way it works is you walk into this warehouse, and outside it's California, of course, so it's quite hot. Almost 95 degrees that day, sweating. And then you walk into an air-conditioned room. Suddenly it's 70 degrees. Oh, it's nice. And then they ask you to fill out some forms, and you walk into the next room, which is called the cool room. That I believe was at about 30 degrees. And suddenly it's a little bit chilly. Then they take you, and you wear this space suit almost. And then you walk into the chill room, which it goes from 30 degrees to I think somewhere around zero or so. That's like pretty cold.
Oh gosh.
And finally you enter the ice cream room, and it's got this cavernous gate, and you open this gate, and it seems like you're entering a labyrinth. Three levels inside the warehouse.
Cool.
It's kind of dark.
Literally,
spotlighting, and you walk in. It's a bit like your dystopian future, except surrounded by ice cream.
Oh my gosh.
It is an extremely difficult job. Like, I could not imagine. We spent about half an hour in that ice cream room walking around, and my phone died. Then after a while, I started taking notes on my little diary. And then my hand was basically shaking so much, it kind of froze up. Like,
well, you just went through 130 degree difference. Yeah.
And then we finally decided that we needed to step back into the real world away from the ice cream room. We actually did take a robot in there. The funniest part was the robot froze, but the computer overheated because we insulated the suit. So then we realized it's going to take some more time to automate ice cream distribution. But hey, every time we eat ice cream, and you know, a small note to everyone out there, do enjoy the creamy, delicious taste, and you know, pay a mental note of regard to the person who actually got it to your plate. So deep respect for all these folks.
Oh, I think we all have a newfound appreciation for delicious ice cream. I love that story, Samir. So as we return to the workplace, Dexterity shows us how robots are powering human capabilities in a collaborative format. Oh my goodness. Thank you so much for talking with us today, Samir. We wish you and Dexterity great success.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us.
You've just listened to the Future Work Playbook. This podcast series is brought to you by Gunderson Dettmer, the world's number one law firm representing venture capital funds and high growth companies. Join Natalie Pierce on our next episode as she and her guests help prepare your organization for the future. Please subscribe to the Future Work Playbook.